It's The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 17th. I'm Tanzina Vega. 150 federal judges have been nominated and confirmed since President Trump took office.
It was like the gift from heaven. We were left judges. They're the ones that judge on your disputes.
We'll take a look at the conservative push to reshape the judicial branch under the Trump administration. Also, a number of cities around the country are building databases to track dishonest police officers, but many of those officers are still not being held accountable.
If they're not including the internal information that they themselves know, the vast majority of police lying will continue to slip through cracks.
Plus, the anticipation of environmental losses from climate change is leading to a phenomenon known as ecological grief.
It's the people who live closest to the land who notice the changes in the land first. It actually not only is a threat to just the way the landscape looks, but it's also a threat to their culture and their way of life.
But first, President Trump's judges. Protesters outside the Senate Judiciary Committee last week demanding the Senate block the confirmation of one of President Trump's federal judicial nominees. Five people were arrested while protesting Stephen Menasche's hearing. He was nominated to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, a seat formerly held by Justice Thurgood Marshall.
My grandfather lost his livelihood after having a dispute with the partners.
Menasche is a former aide to Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and a former lawyer in the Trump administration. His judicial nomination has brought renewed scrutiny to a number of writings he published as a student at Dartmouth that harshly criticize anti-sexual assault groups as well as LGBTQ advocates. In his Senate confirmation hearings last week, both Democrats and Republicans grilled Menasche.
Did you work on the subject matter?
Senator, I worked on immigration
issues. No, it's
issues,
a specific question.
But it would be inappropriate to start weighing
in on.
And
it's inappropriate for you
politics.
To seek this nomination. It is inappropriate for you to sit there and stonewall this committee and refuse to answer any questions about who you are and what you believe.
Senator, I'm happy to be more forthcoming if you have a follow-up. I'm trying to be.
I'm out of time. You took a lot of it by not answering my questions.
And while Menasche still has to be confirmed by the Senate, his nomination is just the latest in a pattern that we've seen since President Trump took office in 2017. Trump has been pushing through judicial nominations far faster than his predecessor. As of last Wednesday, we've seen a total of 150 federal judges confirmed under the Trump administration. That's almost half of President Obama's total nominees over 8 years. President Trump still has 1 year left in his first term. Many of these nominees are very young and very conservative, and some have faced scrutiny for being unqualified for the job. Today in The Takeaway, a fresh look at how Trump is reshaping U.S. courts and how Democrats are responding ahead of 2020. For more, I'm joined by Zoe Tillman, legal reporter with BuzzFeed News. Zoe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Russell Wheeler, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. Russell, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, Zoe, let's start with you. When we look at these nominees who have been confirmed under the Trump administration, does Menasche fit the profile?
He does in a number of ways. As we've seen a number of nominees come out of the Trump administration, especially for seats on the federal appeals courts, which set precedent for the rest of their circuits. You know, very few cases make it up to the Supreme Court, which makes these lower appeals courts that much more important. And so for circuit seats, we've seen nominees like Stephen Menasche come out of the Trump administration, as well as out of private practice, academia. But what they all tend to have in common is a very proven conservative track record, whether that means membership in groups like the Federalist Society, which is the country's preeminent conservative lawyers group, whether it's as a lower court judge, a record of writing opinions on things like abortion, the power of the federal government, gun rights, whether it's academic writings on these issues. So, you know, with Stephen Menasche, he's a known entity to this administration, and they feel confident that he'll fit the mold of the kind of judge that they're looking for.
Russell, give us a picture of how the Trump administration's appointees to the federal courts compares with past presidential administrations. We mentioned he's far outpaced President Obama.
At this point in their presidencies, he's appointed 43 judges to the Court of Appeals, which is many more than any of the presidents going back to Reagan, back to Kennedy, as a matter of fact, at a time in which there were many fewer judgeships. He hasn't been quite as effective in getting district judges confirmed. So if you look at his total appointments, 152, if you include the two Supreme Court justices, which is about 17% of the sitting of the authorized judgeships. But Kennedy, for example, at this point, had appointed 30% of the authorized judgeships, and Trump comes at 17%. He's sort of in the middle of the group from Kennedy to Trump. So we've heard an awful lot, and Zoe was just mentioning the appointments of the Court of Appeals. That's where the Senate and the administration have put all their efforts. Now that there's very few vacancies left on the Court of Appeals, I'm sure they'll turn to the district courts and begin to push those people through.
And Zoe, you've been writing a lot about the differences between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to the judicial strategy. You mentioned the Federalist Society. I'm not sure if there's a Democrat equivalent or a progressive equivalent to that. What are the differences, really, when it comes to how both of the parties are approaching this?
Republicans for decades have made the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, a core voting issue for their base. And in fact, in 2016, President Trump even successfully wooed conservatives who were a bit wary of him, perhaps on other issues, by saying, even if you don't like me, think about the Supreme Court, think about the future of the courts. That is something that will outlast even 4 years, even 8 years. Those are lifetime appointments that will far outlast whatever I do as president. And it's a really effective message. And we heard from even never Trumpers who said they were really pleased with the focus on the courts. And this has been a concerted strategy by the right, really, for decades. And the left, and you'll hear this from advocates on the left, they're the first to admit it, they just haven't had the same focus. And it's been a source of frustration. There is an equivalent to the Federalist Society on the left. It's called the American Constitution Society. But in terms of resources, financially, reach, public awareness, it is far behind a group like the Federalist Society. And so these groups now are trying to build on the anger over things like Justice Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing last year, like the growing awareness of the reach that the Trump administration has had in terms of appointing judges to the federal courts. They're trying to build on that to create momentum going into 2020 and to make it the kind of voting issue that it's been for the right. And so far, it really hasn't broken through. The first three Democratic presidential primary debates, I think I could count on two hands the number of times the Supreme Court came up. So they're working on it. They're trying to push it. But so far, it's still not breaking through the way it has for the right for quite a long time.
Russell, pivoting off of what Zoe was just saying there, I mean, is it too late for the Democrats to get their act together when it comes to the judicial nominee process? I mean, given that, whether historically or even in as we head into 2020, is it just, you know, given where the Trump administration is right now, he's got 1 year left in his current term. Have the Democrats run out of time?
Well, let's put it this way. They really are, in the Senate, they're only bystanders. All they can do is watch, because all the guardrails that used to give the minority some say in selecting judges, the end of the filibuster, which the Democrats did, and then the end of the so-called blue slip rule, which gives home state senators a veto power out of either party, a veto power over nominees from their state. Those are all gone. So the Senate has, like in bulldozer fashion, has just been pushing these nominees through, and there's not much the Senate can do about it. Senate Democrats can do about it. However, the prerequisite for any nomination to a federal court is a vacancy. Right now, there are only four vacancies in the Court of Appeals. There's two more waiting to happen. So if more vacancies don't come along, that puts an end to the Trump effort to reshape the courts, at least in his first term. And I suspect we're not going to see an awful lot more vacancies, especially by Democratic appointees through next year. If he doesn't get reelected, his imprint on the judiciary will be modest at best, I would think. If he does get reelected, it could make a wholesale transformation.
Zoe, there's been some discussion recently about Democrats wanting to, quote, pack the courts. As you mentioned, we've only heard about the Supreme Court in particular just a handful of times in three debates. Do you think this is going to be a more of a focus as the Democratic field narrows for 2020?
We did hear more candidates. In fact, nearly all of the top polling Democratic candidates over the weekend talking about the courts after the New York Times published a piece renewing some of the allegations of sexual misconduct for Justice Kavanaugh back when he was in college. You heard from candidates talking about, should we impeach Justice Kavanaugh, which is a whole other discussion than the kind of court structural court reforms that you hear coming out of liberal legal advocacy groups. But it was really the first time we heard a groundswell of comments from candidates running for president about the court on any topic. You know, whether that goes anywhere remains to be seen. But there are a number of competing plans for the courts coming out of the left. Part of the issue that we've seen is that these groups are not consistent in their message. They haven't agreed on what the message should be to try and rally the base. So we've heard from some groups that want to literally pack the courts. They want to add seats to the U.S. Supreme Court to counterbalance the conservative majority. The way they see it is that by not holding a hearing or voting on President Obama's final Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, in his last year in office, they consider that a stolen seat by the Trump administration that was later filled by Justice Neil Gorsuch. They see Justice Kavanaugh as an illegitimate justice on the Supreme Court, given the issues that came up during his confirmation hearing, and they see this as the only path forward. But there are other groups who say this is unrealistic. It didn't work for Franklin D. Roosevelt, you know, some odd years ago, and it's not going to work this time around. It's dramatic. It's attacking the institution. And they're pitching things like putting in place term limits for justices, adopting a stricter code of ethics. Other groups say the focus shouldn't even be on structural reforms. We just want candidates talking about the kinds of nominees that they're going to put forward if they're elected, you know, trying to convey the message that the only thing worse for liberals than a court that's currently 5-4 with a conservative majority would be a court that is, say, 6-3 or 7-2, and getting that message across. So, you know, we're starting to hear candidates talking about the courts. Some of them are talking term limits. Some have said they're open to court packing. But none of these plans have really become a centerpiece of their policy platform on the campaign trail.
I'd imagine that's frustrating for folks on the progressive left. Russell, we just mentioned Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And while there may be frustration from the Democrats on how they both got their seats, they're both sitting on the Supreme Court. Tell us a little bit about how the Republicans have really been, or how Trump has been able to get his nominees through, especially when we're talking about Kavanaugh, who was just so controversial. I mean, whatever they've done has been working.
Yes, majority vote is what it comes down to. With the filibuster gone, the guardrails that were set up, in a sense, informally to encourage consensus candidates are all gone. So even in Kavanaugh's case, he barely squeaked through the Senate, but the Senate had a majority and they confirmed him. Let me say one other thing. A lot of Trump's lower court appointees also have replaced Republican appointees. So while he's appointed more circuit judges than any other president, he's largely replaced Republicans already. Now, he's replacing Republicans who may have been 70 and middle of the road with Republicans who are 40 and quite conservative. But still, that also limits his impact, it seems to me, on the overall judiciary. We need to wait to see if he's going to get a second term.
Russell Wheeler is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Zoe Tillman is a legal reporter with BuzzFeed News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now to a story about nationwide efforts to track police officers who lie on the job. The actions and testimony of police officers can be central to the outcome of a criminal case. So when an officer's credibility is in question, the stakes are high. Juries can be given misleading information, and the wrong people can end up in jail. In New York City, over the past few years, prosecutors have been creating secret databases to track dishonest officers. And while a number of newly elected DAs around the country are following suit, a new investigation shows that in New York City, unreliable officers are falling through the cracks and still taking the stand. George Joseph is a reporter covering criminal justice here at WNYC, and he's behind this new reporting. George, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So explain the issue for us. I mean, how does a police officer's lying not end up in any official record? And if it does, how is it that they're still ending up on the stand?
Generally, the way these systems work is that prosecutors collect findings of lying that judges or police review bodies issue. But those very formal official findings only happen after an officer has gotten on the stand and actually lied. And what people don't realize is that most of the cases in our criminal justice system are resolved before trial. So prosecutors are the only actors in our criminal justice system that before trial have a really unique window into when officers are lying, because they see the evidence and they hear from the officers. And when they hear something but don't write it down, none of those lies ever make it into the court system.
When folks are on the stand, we all have to take a vow to swear that our testimony is true. What's the penalty for officers who are found to be lying on the stand?
Technically, it is illegal to lie in a criminal court complaint, but prosecutors have been historically very hesitant to put cops in jail for that kind of violation. Although that is starting to change with some of the reform prosecutors across the country. Larry Krasner, for example, of Philadelphia, has started investigating and prosecuting police officers for lying. But in New York, at least, what we have is kind of a consensus where if an officer does something that truly, quote unquote, crosses the line, like making up evidence, sometimes that will be prosecuted. But the day-to-day, like lying about how stops are made, lying about probable cause, that stuff is kind of just given a wink and a nod oftentimes in our system.
And the incentive to lie for the officers is what? So that they're not implicated, so that they're not held accountable for something that they may have done that was inappropriate?
In part, what they're doing is doing what they view as police work, finding a gun, finding drugs, etc., and then making up legal justifications for how they did that after the fact. So it's not always that the officer is making up the existence of drugs or guns or whatever it may be, but they're lying about their constitutional rationale for that stop in the first place.
You have spoken to and about a number of DAs doing this across the country. How widespread is this right now?
We have major cities across the country, Philadelphia, Orlando, St. Louis, our reporting has shown New York, that are developing these databases. But the real question is, how much are these databases actually going to contain? Because if prosecutors are only including things that judges and other bodies have already made for them, they're really doing the bare minimum to not be liable for stuff that could come up from other sources. But if they're not including the internal information that they themselves know, the vast majority of police lying will continue to slip through the cracks.
You mentioned Philadelphia DA Larry Krasner, and he feels pretty strongly about the need for these systems. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
What democracy can put up with a system where the cops get their paycheck and they get to show up if they feel like it, and we have to assume they're telling the truth when we know that's probably not true in a particular case in order to do that? I mean, that's a kidnapping. That is not actually a criminal justice system. That is a criminal justice system kidnapped by corrupt police officers with prosecutors who are entirely complicit. To me, that's absolutely disgusting.
Larry Krasner has some pretty strong language there. Was that what you found with other folks, other DAs that you talked to?
Yeah, so our story interviewed over a dozen New York former or current prosecutors across all five boroughs. And what we got through interviews is an overwhelming sense of DAs know that there's problems with officers lying, and there's problems with DAs tracking officers lying, but they felt their supervisors and their agencies overall didn't want to do as thorough a job as possible of that kind of tracking, because they would start to get backlash from the police department, who they rely on to make their cases.
So Larry Krasner also told you about a recent example of this database being put to use that involved two police witnesses to a crime. Tell us about that.
In court, there were two police witnesses who weren't supposed to be talking to each other. But outside in the hallways, they were speaking to each other, which could mean they were getting their stories straight. It's not clear. We weren't privy to that conversation, but they weren't, bottom line, supposed to be speaking with one another. One of Larry Krasner's prosecutors saw that in the hallway. one of those officers gets on the stand and under oath is asked about, did you have a conversation with this other officer, and said that he did not. He swore that he did not. So he lied in open court. But there's no way to prove that, right? It's only something that the prosecutor knew because he saw it. So he went and made a memo, and now that assessment of a lie is in the Philadelphia prosecutor's database, so that when that officer comes up in the future, DAs will be able to disclose that lie and keep all parties informed of this officer's history.
You mentioned that this is happening in other states around the country. In Orlando, Prosecutor Aramis Ayala, who's the state attorney for the 9th Judicial Circuit Court of Florida, has a separate list for dishonest cops. And here she is talking about those.
Exerting a certain level of violence, mishandling evidence, those are things that would be on the exclusion list. In contrast, when you look at the alert list, those are the ones that we have a little suspicion. You know, you got to comb through this with a fine-tooth comb, but we are not willing to compromise the safety of this community by questioning this person's credibility.
How does what's happening in Orlando compare to what you've seen in New York and perhaps in Philadelphia? Are those lists differently set up?
Both Krasner and Aramis Ayala aren't saying, any whiff of anything wrong, we're going to blacklist you. They're saying, we want to collect data to establish potential patterns. And once we're sure of a pattern through further investigation, we're not going to call this officer anymore because we can't vouch for their credibility. In New York, what we've heard often from former prosecutors is, again, we don't want to ruin an officer's career over something we're not sure of. But the problem is, if you never track the red flags in the first place, you'll never establish a pattern and realize how big the problem actually is.
George Joseph is a reporter covering criminal justice here at WNYC. And all this latest reporting was done with Allie Winston of The Appeal. And we'll have a link to more on this story at our website, thetakeaway.org. George, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're continuing a week of climate coverage here on The Takeaway as part of a collaboration with 250 other media organizations called Covering Climate Now. On Monday, we explored how climate change is causing anxiety for parents and kids and what they can do about it. But today, we take on a different piece of climate and mental health, a phenomenon called ecological grief. Some researchers define it as the grief felt in relation to experienced or anticipated ecological losses from environmental change.
I live in the bush. I live by a beautiful big river. My back door is the Wood Buffalo National Park.
That's Elder Francois Poulette, and he's a Dene Suliné member of the Smith's Landing Treaty 8 First Nation in Canada. He was speaking in Germany at the 2017 COP23, the UN's annual climate conference. For many indigenous communities, climate change is taking its toll on the environment at a disproportionate rate. So for Elder Francois Poulette and many others living on the front lines of the climate crisis, the threat is real, it's present, and it's changing everything.
I live on the land. I also see the effects of global warming in my home. The water that comes by me is polluted. The air that we breathe up north is questionable. There is a changing life up there.
I have two people here to talk with me about ecological grief. Dr. Courtney Howard is an emergency physician, and she's the board president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Dr. Howard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Danzina. Happy to be here.
And Kelton Miner is a PhD candidate in social and behavioral data science at the University of Copenhagen, and he's a research fellow at Crocs Fond Institute for Urban Economic Research. Kelton, welcome to The Takeaway.
So nice to be here.
So Dr. Howard, let's start with you. You've spent a decade living and working with Indigenous communities in the Arctic. How is life being changed by climate change?
climate change is still not covered in most medical curricula, and it certainly wasn't covered 10 years ago when I first came to the high Arctic as a new doctor. And I happened to pick up a book on climate change on my way up, and I read it and got worried and started asking around. And it turned out that in Inuvik, where I was, it was already 3 degrees Celsius warmer than it was in the 1950s. So it's warming at about triple the global rate. And the people there still live a very traditional life. And so what they're finding is that 3 degrees makes a big difference when you're talking about the difference between solid water and liquid water, because they actually use the lakes and the rivers as highways to help them hunt in the wintertime and also to help them connect with their friends and family and cheaply transport building supplies into what would otherwise be flying communities. And so it's impacting their food security. It's impacting the safety of ice-based travel. They're finding that they're a little bit more disconnected because they can't go visit their friends in the neighboring village the way they used to. And you can imagine that when your world starts to look entirely different, it's disconcerting. So permafrost, when it melts, it actually destabilizes the entire slope and it looks like a landslide. And the trees, when their roots become less stable, they tip over. And so they're actually called drunken forests. You know, if you grew up in a place that didn't have those, and then, you know, throughout the course of your lifetime, all of a sudden there's landslides all over, the elders will tell you, you know, it looks entirely different than when I was little. And so the word we use for that is solastalgia. It means feeling homesick when you're still at home.
And tell us a little bit more about solastalgia. Like you said, it's feeling homesick when you're still at home, but how does it relate directly to this concept that we're seeing here? And why was there a need to come up with this new concept?
Well, I think we didn't have words for that feeling of sadness. And what we found last year in Canada is, and we did a case study in ecological grief and eco-anxiety, what has been shown is that it's the people who live closest to the land who notice the changes in the land first. I don't depend on the land nearby for my livelihood, so I'm less likely to be paying super close attention. But it actually not only is a threat to just the way the landscape looks, but it's also a threat to their culture and their way of life.
I want to talk a little bit more, Dr. Howard, in a bit about the diagnostic definition for ecological grief, if there is one. But just for a minute, let me bring in Kelton, because you recently spent some time in Greenland trying to put some data to these feelings that people were having. Tell us a little bit about your research, Kelton.
Sure. You know, when most people think about Greenland with regards to climate change, many think about its melting ice sheet and the projected perils of sea level rise, and perhaps understandably so. In the month of July alone, 197 billion tons of ice from the Greenland ice sheet melted into the ocean. According to the most recent IPCC report, the Arctic is currently warming 2 to 3 times faster, as Courtney touched on, than the rest of the world. But less attention has been paid to what residents living in Greenland's coastal towns and settlements around the ice sheet actually think about recent and ongoing environmental changes across Greenland. So this past year, I had the opportunity to help lead a research team from the University of Greenland and the University of Copenhagen to conduct the first sort of national representative survey. About 2% of all adults in Greenland took the survey from all around Greenland. And since Greenland largely lacks connecting highways and roads between locations, our research teams traveled to reach residents using a combination of small plane, helicopter, and boat, really any means necessary to actually give their voice an opportunity to be heard.
What did the numbers tell us, Kelton?
Yeah, so compared to the U.S., where a recent national survey by Yale and George Mason universities found that about 7 in 10 people think global warming is happening, we found that in Greenland, far more, about 9 in 10 residents think climate change is happening, compared just to 1% who do not. On an individual level, we found that a large majority, over 3 in 4 residents in Greenland, say that they have personally experienced the effects of climate change, suggesting that the effects of climate change are pervasive and widely perceived by the Greenlandic population.
Dr. Howard, we've talked about ecological grief. Is that a diagnosis? And if so, how do you alleviate some of these feelings?
So this is really an emerging area, and it makes sense that it almost feels as though the public conversation is almost leading the clinical conversation, because things are changing so quickly and medical curricula historically changes really slowly. So the medical students are trying really hard to get this into curricula, but mental health is always neglected, whether it's in curricula or in research. So The American Psychological Association has a paper that they put out a couple of years ago called Mental Health and Our Changing Climate that talks about this, but it's certainly not yet in, you know, the DSM-5, which is the thing that we use to issue diagnoses. But what I think is really useful about us talking about this is that when I give presentations, I still often have people coming up to me at the end of a presentation with tears in their eyes saying, you know, I thought I was the only person who was this worried about climate change. Now I know I'm not the only one. And so I think it's really helpful for us to be talking about this because it makes people realize that it's normal to be worried about this change in our planet and what it means for our health and our kids' health. And that is the start of bringing us into conversation. And the great part about that is that's the start of looking for solutions.
Dr. Howard, we've been focusing on Indigenous populations here since many are closest to the most visible effects of climate change. But I'm wondering if any of what they're experiencing also extends to others. Can we learn from it?
I think we're all living in an environment that's changing, and it's just that it was easiest to pick up first in the place that was changing the fastest. But now that we're seeing heat waves, you know, sending people to hospital and big clouds of smoke coming from wildfires and communities being devastated, you know, we're all on this planet together. And I think it makes sense that we're feeling this way now. And so what I think is important is that talking about it does start to make people feel better immediately. And when we start to create solutions together, the psychological literature, again, it's emerging, shows that we start to feel better about it. So action feels better than anxiety. So, you know, here in Yellowknife, after our bad wildfire summer, we got together as neighbors and we said, hey, let's make some clean energy, you know, let's do something about this. And we had a bunch of potlucks and we ended up doing a big bulk buy for solar panels. So there was new bling in the neighborhood and we had new friends. And that's the kind of thing that built that web of resilience where if there ever was an emergency in the neighborhood, now I know who the elderly person is down the block who might need some help. And meanwhile, we're starting to speed along the low carbon transition that we know we need to do in order to keep ourselves safe. So a psychiatrist here in Canada, Greg Dubord, has told me before, you know, I wouldn't medicate this. I would prescribe climate action because the world's sending up danger signals to us and humans have survived this long by heeding those danger signals and taking action. You know, if you put your head out of a tent and there's a bear there, you're going to go, ah, you're going to have a moment of acute anxiety, and then you're going to run away from the bear. That's our chance now, is to go, oh my goodness, we're seeing the changes. It doesn't feel good. Scientists are telling us it's going to get worse. Let's get together, talk about how we feel, and make a plan. I think many of us are now at the point where we're trying to align the way we live our lives with the way it is now apparent we need to live them. And that's a process and nobody's perfect, but I think we're starting to make some real changes and we can feel good about that.
Kelton, do people in Greenland have a sense of how they're going to cope with climate change as the Arctic warms even more?
Certainly. I mean, what's very apparent in Greenland is that whether you ask people about their perceptions of recent sea ice changes or recent changes in nearby glaciers or just their thoughts about climate change in general, we find that people are much more likely to feel negative sentiment about those changes, those recent changes. And this raises some interesting questions, like how, you know, might they cope with both those feelings and anxieties, but also very practical and real changes that they experience around them. We found that actually 8 in 10 residents think that the sea ice has become more dangerous to travel on in recent years. So just to put that perspective, about a quarter of the population in Greenland went on the sea ice at least once in the past year. And the sea ice is sort of this connective tissue, especially in north and northwestern Greenland and eastern Greenland, that links all of these communities and livelihoods and resources together, allows people to do activities that they've conducted for a long time and that have been passed down from generation to generation. We found that actually over 3/4 of the population get at least some of their diet from local foods that they hunt, fish, or gather. And when we asked people about whether they thought climate change would harm or benefit fishing and hunting in the future, we actually found that far more residents think that climate change will harm those sort of core industries and parts of the really cultural ancestry and identity of Greenland than would benefit them. But interestingly, we also found that 1/3 of the population, or over 1/3, think that climate change will actually benefit shipping, agriculture, as well as mining and tourism. And I think this suggests that as people are adapting to these changes, there is a simultaneous sort of chain of events of both adapting existing ways of life and also trying to make the most of these emergent opportunities to really not only survive, but also to thrive.
And Dr. Howard, just to round out the conversation here, I mean, we mentioned treatment would not be medical per se or medication per se, but climate activism. But beyond that, I mean, what are the implications of this? You know, as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing growing anxiety among young people about climate change in the world as it is starting to unfold before them. What kinds of effects will these symptoms of ecological grief have collectively as climate change gets worse?
When a patient comes into the emergency department, and we have a high burden of mental health up here in the north, and so I see a lot of patients with mental health issues, you know, your first job is to make sure they're safe. So are they a danger to themselves? Are they a danger to their community? Are they functioning? And so, you know, if people are feeling really worried about the climate, I have spoken with people who've fallen into deep depression and become suicidal. So it's important that if people are not safe, that they go see a physician. Number two, you know, really talking about it, being isolated with these feelings is really the worst. It's a second type of suffering that we don't need to have. And so coming into community to start to discuss with one another, talk about those feelings and come up with solutions really is, I think, going to be the cornerstone of this, because action definitely feels better than anxiety. And meanwhile, you know, I think it's really important that we start to develop some insight into how these feelings are impacting our judgment as you're trying to figure out how to help somebody. You ask yourself, okay, do they know how they're feeling? And do they know, is that impacting what they do? Because it makes me wonder if that sort of bad feeling that climate change gives us is making us avoid it and avoid tackling it. Whereas if we talk about how it's making us feel more, maybe we'll come to a more centered understanding and a centered place emotionally that will help us in terms of our judgment and our actions. So I think we have a lot of discussion to do as a society. And overall, even I know how painful it is to be feeling this way for so many people, I think it may actually be the start of some of our most productive coping.
Kelton, what lessons should people outside of the Arctic take away from your findings?
I think one of the key findings is that even though we often think about climate change and talk about global warming on the global level, it's really important to realize that many of these Arctic communities and really some of the communities that are most susceptible to these ongoing changes are often removed from view. And it's really important to realize that, you know, these places are warming faster than the rest of the world. So even though they're disproportionately affected by climate change, they are also some of the communities least responsible for these changes. So there is an element of environmental justice that should be taken into account. And I also think, you know, importantly, that we can learn from the ingenuity and clever creativity of communities in the Arctic that are already adapting to climate change in ingenious ways.
Kelton Miner is a PhD candidate in social and behavioral data science at the University of Copenhagen, and he's a research fellow at Kraks Fond Institute for Urban Economic Research. And Dr. Courtney Howard is the board president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. Thanks to you both.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for covering this.
Thanks so much.
Tomorrow, we're going to continue our climate change coverage with a look at how television meteorologists are talking to their viewers about global warming.
It's actually not as difficult as you might think. If you know that your producer has a story leading into weather that maybe is about the fire season or the drought or whatever, you can lead that into maybe a quick 30 or 60 second primer on climate change. Just talking about, you know, the trends that we're seeing, what we would expect to see with a warmer world. We'll get more drought, we'll get more wildfire seasons there longer, etc. So you can slide these little nuggets of truth in there fairly easily into your weathercast.
And that's our show for today. As always, you can call us to weigh in on anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.